The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Yes, it is. Coming to you from the Carter Subaru Studio. Welcome. Welcome to The Big Show. Got a lot of news to talk about nationally. Democrats are trying an unprecedented attempt to take over the Supreme Court. I've never seen anything like this. And then if Republicans get control in 2022, we'll add four new Republican justices then, right? This is madness, what we're seeing at our nation's level. And we're seeing madness here in our state as well. And I'm gonna prep you. This first topic that I have today is really awful. And it's awful to listen to. But it's a story that must be told. It's one that you would not hear otherwise. Let's get right to The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. Top story.
We have been told for more than a year now that our schools must be closed to protect the children. We've had teachers' unions telling us that, and it's because the teachers don't want to go back to work in person. Or the unions don't want their members to go back. But the fact that so many members haven't quit their union membership is, it's disgusting. But I want you to know the toll of this decision. Because those of us who have worked or work in the public schools, or private schools for that matter, one of the things that we're trained to do is to look for signs of abuse. We're supposed to be the safety net for the children. And we've seen the news reports about how child abuse has skyrocketed in the last year. You have a combination of so many people suffering economically, and these parents are taking it out abusively on their children. And then you don't have the safety net of the school and school workers to watch out for the welfare of children who are being horribly, horribly abused. And so I'm going to tell you the story about a kid in our state. His name is Carrion Walker Franks. Carrion was 8 years old when his aunt and uncle, Felicia Adams and Jesse Franks, adopted him. Carrion was autistic, developmentally disabled, incontinent, nonverbal, partially blind, but he would still go to school, went to Mountain View High School down in Vancouver, Washington. He would still go to school, and I tell you, the special education workers in our schools, they're pretty special. Because there's not a lot of rewards. You know, when you're working with a child, you know, it's mandated that education must be provided to all kids. And for the special ed workers, you just don't get a lot of rewards. But you're there for these kids. And so school closed. Carrion stayed home with his aunt and uncle. But what we now know from his two siblings, who are also in this home, who last year were ages 12 and 14, they told a state CPS worker that they would get beatings, that their aunt and uncle would pull down their pants and beat them with paddles, with electrical cords. One time the beating was so severe the paddle broke. Carrion, he seemed to be motivated by one thing when he would be at school, and that was food. Food was a big And by the way, let me give credit to the Vancouver Columbian newspaper, which did an unbelievable job reporting this story. And I want to make sure that I give proper attribution to the Vancouver Columbian, because It's a heartbreaking and fantastic bit of reporting. So the siblings said they were getting beatings in the home. And there was nobody there to be a safety net, because the teachers were all working from home. The schools were closed. As I started saying, Carrion was motivated by food. He would eat when food was put in front of him. But his aunt told the school employees, when he was in school, I'm talking about before February of last year, his aunt would say, "Don't feed him. We don't want you to feed him." And she would withhold food from him all the time. She would only send one diaper a day to school with Carrion. And he would soil himself usually more than once a day. Apparently, these beatings continued, and the aunt and uncle started starving this little boy, this autistic little boy, blind, in a wheelchair, but still one of God's creatures. And the aunt and uncle started starving him. Nobody there to pick up the pieces. Oh, yeah, there was. There was state CPS. This isn't just a damning indictment of the schools and the fact that the selfishness of all of these people who refuse to go back to work is killing far more children than COVID-19 ever has. But there was still one safety net. The state of Washington, CPS. CPS went to check on Carrion in early November. And they didn't talk to him. He's non-communicative. They didn't really even look at him. But the Carrion's sister, or I'm sorry, his aunt's sister, told child welfare authorities that her sister, his aunt, had been withholding food from the boys for years. The boys had to steal food when they wanted to eat. And they would steal enough to bring home to their autistic brother as well. And his aunt's sister, who's another aunt, in the same interview with CPS, told authorities with the state of Washington that Carrion had collapsed from malnourishment. That her sister, his aunt, removed doorknobs from one bedroom to ensure the children could not leave their room or the house. So a child welfare worker for the state of Washington, her name is Katina Gonzalez, she interviewed the younger brothers, Carrion's younger brothers, at the family's home down in Vancouver. She saw Carrion, but she didn't interact with him because he couldn't communicate. But she did hear about the beatings. The brothers told her about the one with the paddle until it broke, and then an extension cord. They didn't do anything. The state of Washington didn't do anything. Nancy Gutierrez is a spokeswoman for the Washington Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and she wouldn't comment on what DSHS did, if anything. After this home visit, she said, "Oh, we have privacy rules." Well, Carrion died in November of last year. When he was in school a year earlier, they estimated that he was a thin boy, but certainly not unhealthily thin. They estimated that he weighed about 120 pounds a year earlier. When he died, he was 65 pounds. After his death, Vancouver police interviewed his high school and middle school teachers as part of the investigation. And they told him that, about the diapers and about how the aunt would refuse to send food with him, ordered the school employees to not give him any food. But the aunt made money. The government sent her money for caring for these three boys that she had. She got $4,300 a month from the government to care for the three children. $4,300 a month. She also got a salary. She works for a healthcare nonprofit called Care Oregon. When you get that much money, why couldn't you feed the kids? Well, as the police investigation unspooled, they found out that the aunt and uncle spent a lot of time at the, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's the casino that's right alongside I-5, is it Ilwani? Turns out they went to that casino a lot. They started checking security tapes, started checking their players' club cards, and they found out that while this boy was starving to death in the house, that his aunt had spent 1,261 hours at the casino. Her lifetime loss at this casino was $238,000. The uncle, he spent 977 hours at the casino. His lifetime loss, $43,000. They gambled away $281,000. As I said, Carrion died in November of last year. 3 hours after he died, his aunt spent more than 4 hours playing slots at the same casino. Felicia Adams lost far. Felicia Adams lost $421 3 hours after he died. What has happened to us? How can teachers' unions hear these stories and say, yeah, we're still going to try to drag our feet and get back into the schools? We don't care that we're the safety net. Kids are fine on their own. These kids are killing themselves, they're overdosing, starving to death. How can they justify this? No child has died because of COVID-19 in a school that has reopened. Most of the country has been reopened for the entire school year or for several months of the school year. How does a state of Washington CPS employee see this kid hours, or I'm sorry, days before he dies? He died at 65 pounds. She couldn't see that he was starving to death? A state worker? I'll ask you a very serious question. People want to blame cops and hold cops responsible for involuntary manslaughter. What should we do with a CPS worker who sees a kid who is dying and, well, they won't tell us what actions were taken. Privacy laws, you know. And then this aunt and uncle who have been collecting almost $60,000 a year from the taxpayers and just gambling it all away at a casino. I mean, there's so much to blame here. How about a casino that joyfully, oh, we got us a whale, joyfully has a woman come in and lose $238,000. And that just adds to the bottom line. It's great. She's a preferred customer. Whew. We've gone insane as a society. We really have. There's some great state workers, and I've known people who have worked for DSHS, and like I said about special education teachers in the schools, there aren't a lot of rewards often. And I know it's a tough job. I get it's a tough job. But there are a lot of people who work for the government who just don't do their job. And I don't know what they did about this little boy. They won't tell us. They should. We got, you know, the Seattle schools, man. You hear their solution? They got a homeless encampment on school property at that Broadview K-8. What are they going to do about that? Well, they finally have made up their mind. Are they going to clear the heroin addicts, the criminals, the people who are illegally camping on school property? No. No, Seattle School Board won't let that happen. They've ordered the city to not clear the encampment. They just announced today that they've told the students and the staff, when they come back to school, enter and exit through the door on Greenwood Avenue, because that's furthest away from the encampment. That's a solution. Well, just try to stay as far away as possible. You know, it's no alcohol, no drugs, no weapons on school grounds. Well, since the campers are allowed to have all of those things, how do you keep the kids from doing that? I know so many people who the center of their universe, and this is true for my wife and me, is being parents. And when you hear about these kids who are just lost, and then what the government has done, you have one layer of safety in DSHS, and they didn't do anything to save this kid. You have another layer of safety in our schools, and those teachers would rather have the ease of working from home than being shepherds for their kids. Man, we're getting more and more lost every day. This is insanity. And I'm sorry to be so emotional, but I thought this was a story that people need to hear. What's your big lead for today?
The Big Lead on Cairo Radio.
All right, we'll check the news for you. And then I have a lot of other news to get to. We got you covered here as the Dory Monson Show gets rolling. I'm really sorry. And don't dog me for how I say the word sorry. I don't know what I'm doing wrong when I say sorry. But I'm really sorry. I was not expecting to get so emotional. I read that story this morning, and I was emotional as I was reading it. But I thought I got all of that out of me. But then as I was telling you the story, it got me. It just absolutely got me. A bunch of text messages. What's happened to the aunt? And the aunt is his mom. She adopted the kid back in 2012. What's happened to the aunt and uncle? Well, they are the subject of a police investigation in the boy's death, but they have not been arrested. I've gotten a lot of questions. People asking how in the world a state care worker could leave the boy in the home. I do not know. I wish I had answers to so many of your questions. But no, the aunt and uncle have not yet been charged, and again, it is his mother, as he is adopted. So I'm going to stay on top of this story, though. I'll try to give you follow-ups as the investigation continues into the kid's death. I will tell you that in the report the police report that has been filed, they did cite the closure of the schools as a greatly contributing factor to this kid's death because there were not school employees there to help save him. So that is part of the record. We're not just making up that this is the fault of the teachers refusing to go back to work. And, I mean, let's face it, it's not just Steve, it's Jay Inslee, you know, who made these orders to close the schools and you gotta stay 6 feet apart, 3 feet apart, play your band instrument inside a nylon shell. That'll make everything fine. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. So the defense has rested in the Derek Chauvin trial, the cop accused of murder of George Floyd. Kim Potter, the cop who shot the 20-year-old guy a few days ago, she's facing manslaughter charges. I want to talk about a similar type case closer to home. But first, I want to talk about numbers, stats, data. Because one thing has happened that is, and I do think the media is complicit in this. And I do feel a responsibility if I think things have swung completely out of control in how things are communicated. I feel a responsibility to be a counterbalance to that. But why did that 20-year-old break away when he was being handcuffed in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, a few days ago? Why did he break away? Did he have a realistic view of how that encounter was going to go? Or has he heard the stories that are repeated so often about how cops are out of control and all cops are B-words and on it goes? Did he have a ridiculously exaggerated sense of fear that day? Because I've heard John Curley give these numbers on Tom and Curley's show, and I pulled them up in front of me here. A Los Angeles-based magazine in February, they published a survey showing that half of self-described liberal people, or either liberal or very liberal, they believe that 1,000 or more unarmed black men are killed by police every year. 35% of liberal and very liberal people believe the number is as high as 10,000 or more unarmed black men killed by police every year. Even moderates, 66% believe 100 or more unarmed black people are killed every year. 54% of self-described conservatives and very conservative respondents believe it's 100 or more. Let's talk about the reality. Let's talk about truth. Let's talk about data. According to the Washington Post database on police shootings, in 2020, 18 unarmed black people were killed by police. The year before, it was 13. And as Daniel Horowitz points out in a column, unarmed doesn't necessarily mean unarmed. In many cases, they have an automobile, they're trying to run down the cops. There's a struggle, hand-to-hand combat struggle, reaching for a cop's gun. Here's the truth of the matter that everybody seems to be afraid to talk about because the truth is denounced. Because so many people are exploiting these, you know, phony numbers and ginning up so much fear. And it's truly leading to the deaths of people. The truth of the matter is, if you're a young black man and you don't struggle or run or resist, your chance of being killed by a cop is pretty much zero. In fact, you have a much greater chance of being struck by lightning than being killed by a cop. Now, I'm bringing this up because we have a local story in our news today. Out of the city of Kent, there was a 20-year-old young black man in Kent, Giovanni Joseph McDade. Back in 2017, Police say they tried to pull Giovanni over for a traffic violation, but he sped away. There was a police chase of his vehicle. It ended at a dead-end road, and a patrol car and Giovanni's car collided, according to the police. And then Giovanni tried to ram an officer with his vehicle. So another cop opened fire and hit Giovanni multiple times, and he died at the scene. I mean, all deaths are tragic, but there has been investigation. The city of Kent says the cops acted within Kent police and Washington state law. But get this, the city of Kent has agreed to pay Giovanni Joseph McDade's family $4.4 million in settlement over his death. And in addition to the settlement, the city says it will design and install a bench in a city park to memorialize the young man. I wish that more in the media would give the truth of the numbers, because I do believe that many of these young black men who try to break away, try to run, struggle with the cops, whatever it is, they believe that their chance of being killed is thousands of times greater than it actually is. And that often leads to tragic consequences. So I want to give the stats there in wake of this Kent settlement with the family. Quick time out. And then we got a lot more to cut, including plummeting trust in the vaccine. Now that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been pulled from the market, what is this going to mean for America that's growing increasingly skeptical? Tell you about that coming up next here on the Dory Monson Show. Well, as I've shared with you, I got my second vaccine shot on Sunday, and it just laid me out. And I was so sick Monday, I couldn't do the show. I got the Moderna. And then we also told you, Nicole, she got... Hey, Nicole, which one did you get? I don't even remember.
I got Johnson & Johnson. I actually just got a text about an hour ago saying, if you have any of these side effects, be sure to call a doctor because it's, you know, been halted and all that.
They say it's, you know, there have been like 6 million J&J vaccines given, and there have been 6 cases of this horrible clotting, blood clotting. So they say it's a 1 in 1 million chance. And it's interesting. One of my daughters was supposed to get the Johnson & Johnson a couple of, I think, 2 days ago. Got a text that morning saying, nope, it's canceled. They're putting a pause on Johnson & Johnson. So she went and got the...
Pfizer.
She went. How do you know my daughters better than I do?
I know.
You communicate with my daughters more. Yeah, she got the Pfizer, and she said to me, she said, "No, I would have rather have just gotten a one shot Johnson & Johnson." She goes, "I'll roll the dice, 1 in 1 million chance," but apparently that's not true for most of America, because before the CDC announced the pause, 52% of Americans thought the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was safe. 52% thought it was safe, 26% unsafe. So 2 to 1, it's safe. So after this pause...
Oh, go ahead.
Well, let me give this stat, yeah. then go to that. After the pause, it's now upside down in public confidence. 37% think it's safe, 39% think it is unsafe in a poll that's just out today. So yeah, people just, I mean, I wonder if this is eroding the faith in the Pfizer and the Moderna too.
I don't know if it's, I don't know if it was their strategy to say, look how fast we paused it because we got these concerns, and they're trying to say, this is how safe all of these are because we're taking these steps, right? Or if it did more damage by overreacting, because I know someone who works in infectious disease at UW, and they said that all the doctors there were like, this is ridiculous, because in that big of sample, you would have blood clots. Like that's a thing that happens, and you'd probably have more than six. So it's not, it's a weird pause. I think it was a bit of an overreaction. I don't mind the overreaction, but if it's going to, you know, discourage people, I don't know that if that's what they were going for.
Well, yeah, and it's gotten played up so big. You know, it's been our top of the hour CBS, and it's a big story. I mean, what the CDC are the ones who called the pause. But, man, if that's going to erode the faith in all of the vaccines, and mine was...
They're,
you know, like
so different, though. So the reason I was kind of for the Johnson & Johnson, and granted, this is just from all the stuff I read, and you know, I'm sure somebody's going to tell me it's not right, whatever. But the Johnson & Johnson is kind of an old science. It's like a flu shot. It's a dead cold cell, and they put it in you, and it creates that reaction, you know, teaches your body, whatever. Whereas the Pfizer and Moderna are a new technology that takes this rDNA and, like, goes kind of, tells your DNA to produce this protein, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it's a new science. So that's why there's less information about it, because it's a brand new science, really.
Right. But then that still makes me wonder. And I'm mm-hmm. you know, obviously, since I got the vaccine, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. But as sick as I was on Monday, because I let, you know, them inject this into me, I didn't let them. I sought it out. I was fully in control of my decision making there. I'm not blaming anybody else. But you know, as untested as all of these are, that's why I've said I don't care. I don't think that it's a horrible thing if my daughters don't get the vaccine, because I still think the possible downside, if we find out 1 year, 3 years, or 5 or 10 years from now that there's something in the, you know, the most lightly tested vaccines in history, you know, the Pfizer and the Moderna, I don't know what the ramifications are going to be, but sure. I still think the downside, I mean, if I got that sick from that vaccine, COVID would have killed me.
Another theory is that if you get that sick, it means you possibly already had the antibodies, because you already had COVID. So that's another that's another theory on why you get sick. But then also the Moderna, I don't know what this means, but it has no cap on the RNA. The Pfizer does. So people tend to get more sick on Moderna because it does not have a cap on the RNA, whatever that means.
Yeah, that's what I've
but
heard.
But so there are there are reasons for getting sick out there. And so there, it's not like that wasn't expected. You thought you could, superhuman it. But
about 6 months ago, I had a blood test, and I said, "Hey, can you test me for COVID too? Just tell me if I ever, you know, if I've had it and didn't get sick from it." And the blood test said you may have had or may have the antibodies. And then I asked my doctor, and they said, "No, don't pay attention to that." Everything is an unknown. Everything's an unknown right now. But the pause on the Johnson & Johnson has ruined America's faith in it. Check the news. Fast 15 coming up next.